This week, June 16th, 2015, on The Digital Story, a portrait tip for solo shooters, five photo tips from the Eastern Sierra, the Leica Q, did they get it right? All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to this week's show. I literally just walked in the door, driving back from Bridgeport, California in the Eastern Sierra for our fantastic inaugural Eastern Sierra photo workshop. We had a great time. We had nine shooters plus Leah and myself camping out, not literally, at a very nice place actually, the Silver Maple Inn in Bridgeport, California. And we visited Mono Lake, we visited Bodie, we went to secret spots in the hills. We did portrait shoot in downtown Bridgeport, we hung out together, we did reviews, and we really had a terrific time. So out of that event, I have five tips that I'm bringing back from the Eastern Sierra for those of you who weren't able to join us, at least not this time, right? And I also have some other goodies for you, a nice little portrait thing that I think you're going to like if you find yourself shooting portraits by yourself. We have a weekly update. We have virtual camera club news. We have some stuff to do here. So let's get to it. The weekly update. The Leica Q Type 116 is a 24 megapixel full-frame compact camera with fixed 28 millimeter f1.7 lens. And this is reported by imagingresource.com. And they say, Leica announced the Leica Q, a fixed-lens compact camera that packs a 24-megapixel full-frame sensor and 28mm f1.7 lens into a compact frame. Despite its small size and much more wallet-friendly price, the Leica Q still dons the German manufacturer's signature red dot and rigorous build quality brought over from Leica's M-series digital rangefinders. To coincide with the release of the Q camera, Leica has developed a camera-specific iOS app that will let you remotely control camera settings. The Leica Q is available starting right now for $4,250. As with all Leica cameras, the Q comes with a free copy of Adobe Lightroom 6. And that would be the perpetual license, the one that you put on your computer. So this is very interesting. I think that I have probably read more editorial about the Leica Q than any Leica camera in recent memory. And I would say more positive editorial. A lot of people are really jazzed about this camera. And I think there are a few reasons for that. First of all, I don't think they wandered off the beaten track like they did with some of their other recent offerings. This camera very much looks like a Leica. It feels like a Leica. It's built like a Leica. It has a magnificent 28mm f1.7 lens, a Leica lens. And if you think about the price, which is still, you know, it's up there. Come on, $4,250. But you think about how much you would pay for a 28mm Leica lens, an f1.7, and then you think about the camera that you get with it. In the world of Leica, this isn't a terrible proposition at all. Probably one of their more attractive, functional, really tempting offerings, a full-frame sensor. Now, it's interesting, the thing about Leica that I love is they always have to put in parentheses what type it is. In this case, it's type 116, type 116, just to make sure that you don't get it confused with a different Leica Q. I think there's only one Leica Q out there. At any rate, for those of you that want a real Leica, not, you know, one of the, you know, Leica with Panasonic stuff in it, but you know, a camera that really looks like and performs like the Leica M series that, you know, really gets everyone's juices going. This Leica Q is not a bad proposition at all. Now, one thing I will say about it, and this is, again, this is just me, but having only a 28 millimeter lens, for me, really limits my photography. I mean, one of the things I love about, you know, my mirrorless cameras is that I can have a 28, I can have a 40, and I can have, let's say, a 75 with me and switch as needed. So, you know, I do say there are times when I'm only going to shoot with one lens. There are times when I only take one lens. But personally, and this is not just the Leica camera, it's also the Sony camera and anyone else that just has a fixed focal length lens. Sigma is doing it also. That's always tough for me, especially at $4,250. At any rate, that being said, if I were to buy a brand new Leica rangefinder today, this full frame beauty, this Q, would probably be the one. In other news, Lens Pro To Go suffers theft of estimated $500,000 in gear. F-Stoppers reports an early estimate of $500,000 worth of mostly Nikon, Canon, and Sony equipment was taken out through a hole made in the drywall and smashed windows. The thieves gained access through a storage closet and then cut through an interior wall in the shipping department. Lens Pro To Go's Facebook page commented that this was likely to avoid motion detectors. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. And also, thankfully, a lot of their gear was out in customers' hands, of course, which did not get stolen. I just thought this was very interesting. I mean, $500,000 worth of gear, and someone really planned this, what appears to be a somewhat professional type heist to go in and get this. This is not brand new stuff. This is used stuff, right? I mean, they went to all this trouble to steal used stuff. And then on top of that, of course, this company, they're a professional company, Lens Pro To Go, and they have serial numbers on everything. So I don't think it's like a gun where you file off the serial number and then sell it to some guy in a dark alley somewhere. I don't know. To me, this is a goofy heist, in all honesty, stealing used equipment that is all, you know, accounted for. You know, chances are if you steal something out of someone's house, you know, where you get, let's say, $10,000 of the equipment, which is not hard to do these days, there's a very good chance that they don't have all those serial numbers recorded and ready to go because, you know, people have varying degrees of accounting for their stuff. But a company that does this, well, okay. Anyway, that is this week's weekly update. Story number one, 5 photo tips from the Eastern Sierra. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, I just drove back from Bridgeport, California, where we had a very enjoyable experience. The photographers I spent time with were fantastic. Not only were they good shooters, they were good people. And I tell you, when you're working in the outdoors, when you're on the road and you're hanging out with good people, that makes all the difference in the world. And I think that has so much to do with why I had a good time. I know Leah had a good time, and it seemed like everyone attending was enjoying themselves. So that being said, however, you know, we were in a different environment than we normally work in. We were at 7,000 feet in Bridgeport where we were hanging out. When we went to Bodie, we went up to 8,000 feet. We were out in the field for long periods of time while we were working. The weather was absolutely beautiful, but it was sunny. We were out in the sun, especially at Bodie. We arrived there at 9 a.m. That's when the park opens. And I think we headed out, I want to say 2 o'clock, something like that, before we came back. And including eating lunch there, which we did, we were in the sun the whole time, you know. So that at 8,000 feet, that has some effects. So I thought I would bring back a few photo tips for those of you that weren't able to join us, at least not this time, not just about dealing with altitude environment and all that. I think that you can get anywhere, but there were some specific things that we learned while we were there. And that's why I want to pass along to you so that you can benefit from the trip in a few small ways. So here we go. Number one, talk to strangers. Unlike urban life, where we generally avoid contact with strangers, just the opposite is helpful in rural areas. Just over the last week, I learned of a handful of new spots to visit that are off the beaten track. Each one of them was the result of talking to someone I didn't previously know. And I think this is fascinating to me because no matter where I was on this trip, and of course I've been in this area many, many times, but I'm talking just about this trip, just to kind of put a sharper point on it, whether we were waiting, you know, on the highway for a road construction to kind of clear for a few minutes and get out of a car and talk to the person in the car right behind us, in a restaurant while we were waiting for our food, out on the street, browsing around and running into people there, at the inns, everywhere we went. There were, of course, some people, not the density that we'd have in urban life, but there were folks hanging out. And the difference is that it's very easy in general to talk to these folks. Even at Bodhi, I would just strike up a conversation with people who were there enjoying it. And a lot of times they were people who knew the area really well. And as a result, I learned of a number of places that I didn't know about. Oh, you should go up this road up to that canyon. You should go check out this creek. You should do this. You should do that. You should see this mine that's over here. Did you know there are hot springs over there? You know, all that kind of stuff. And most of the time, I did not know it. I honestly did not know of these places that they were talking about, and they were very interesting. And I kept a log of them, and I have them. I'm going to check them out next time I go up. I'm hoping to go back up in the fall and check them out. And I just thought, this is terrific, because a lot of this stuff isn't written down, or it wouldn't come up in a normal search, or you wouldn't even know what to ask. And I got all of this information just by being relaxed and talking to folks that are in the environment there and really listening to what they have to say. Plus, it was fun. And I just think that, for me, that's a big difference than in urban life, where people are a little bit more hesitant to talk to you. They're probably more in a hurry. City life isn't as conducive to casual conversation like this. And they don't really have, you know, they're not really going to go, hey, did you try that restaurant over there? They're not going to do that kind of thing as much. And if they did, even I would think that might be a little odd. So anyway, when you're out and about in urban settings, I think talking to strangers is great, because I think you learn so much about their area. Most of the time, they're happy to share that with you. And not only will it help your photography, it just helps make the trip in general more fun. Tip number two, know your physical limits. Traveling puts a strain on the body, and visiting high altitude locations even more so. Be honest with yourself about how far you should push your body while on the road. Yes, great shots are important, but good health should always top the list. And I just think that this is a good reminder, because I think we forget sometimes that not all locations are the same. And I think that sometimes we fail to acknowledge the toll that travel takes on us, thinking that, yeah, we can travel for 3 days straight and then somehow get up at the crack of dawn and, you know, be out there doing something, and maybe ignoring the effects that has on our body. You know, this is something I'm as guilty of as the next guy. And one of the things that I've learned is that by planning, you know, how much time I'm going to have to rest, you know, between, you know, relocating and going back out there and hiking and shooting and so forth, And, you know, working in buffer zones, so to speak, has helped a lot. Just as we're trying to be aware of our camera gear and all the other stuff that's going on with travel, itinerary, and so forth, add to the list, because we forget to do this, add to the list your own personal health, you know, to make sure that you're in good shape so you really can enjoy this adventure that you're on. Tip number three, work in pairs. Many remote locations don't have cell phone coverage. We forget that because we're so used to having it everywhere. So it's important to travel with a photo buddy to assist you if something goes awry. Plus, it's fun hanging out with someone and, you know, comparing notes and looking at something and going, what do you think? I don't know. What do you think? I'm going to try to shoot it this way. And just having someone to maybe talk with while you're hiking back to the car and all that good stuff. I just think that photo buddies are great for adventure photography. Not only is it wise in terms of safety, I just think it makes the whole experience a lot better. And I'm just always very nervous about people wandering off alone. So I, you know, at our workshops, at the Digital Story Workshops, I make sure that people are going in small groups or at least have a buddy when they're going out there. I try to discourage people wandering off too far by themselves. I want everyone to be able to get the shots they want. But if you're here, you know, and you can see someone 200 yards away or 100 yards away, and you have that visual contact, that should not interfere with your photography, but it certainly seems like a good idea. And then after you're done shooting, catch up to them and you guys can talk a little bit. So anyway, I just think that photo buddies are a great idea. I'm very high on them, not only for travel photography, but just in general, at home and when you go out on the weekend. Or I know a couple of guys that meet in San Francisco every Friday and they do street shooting together. This is good stuff. Photo buddies are good stuff, and it's something that I think works whether you're on the road or you're at home. Tripods are still relevant. Street shooters don't need them often, but working in the great outdoors demands a tripod now and again. Long exposures, HDRs, high-quality panos, and twilight shooting all need a good set of sticks. At least put them in the trunk of the car so they're accessible while you're on the road. And I have to say that most of the time when I'm using a tripod is when I'm in the situation that I was in the Eastern Sierra. I'm outdoors working. I'm at the edge of the day. I want to try some HDR work. I want to work with twilight, lighting, all that kind of stuff. Even I, the nimble photographer, will have a tripod strapped to my back. I think that finding a good tripod that you're comfortable carrying and having a comfortable way to carry it while you're in the field makes a big difference. If you have this bulky, unwieldy tripod that, you know, you always have to be holding in one hand or something like that, that might discourage you from, you know, taking out of the trunk of the car and carrying it with you on a short hike. So having a tripod that, you know, works with the way that you like to travel on foot and is comfortable, but yet you have it when you need it and it's nice and sturdy. Very important still, very important. We are not in the age with, no matter how good image stabilization and so forth is, there are situations where you need a tripod. It's a good idea to have one that you think works well with you when you're in remote locations or, you know, you're traveling on foot. Tip number four, practice first with neutral density filters. This was something that came up actually a couple times over the course of the workshop where we had some good discussions about what happened, especially with color, when using neutral density filters. And again, we were in high altitude, and you know, so the UV light's a little different and so forth. But more than one person noticed some color shifts when using their high quality neutral density filters. And we talked about that. And I just think it's a good idea before you're out there in the field shooting shots that you might not see again. I think it's a good idea to know how your neutral density filter is going to perform before you do that. And if it has any quirks, you'll be able to take that into account while you're shooting. And finally, tip number 5, review your images each night. And again, this goes back to the thing that, boy, you know, we can look at our shots on that 3-inch LCD on the back of our camera and think we had a fantastic shoot. And you very well may have had a fantastic shoot, but until you really look at them on high quality tablet, you know, such as my iPad with Retina display or your laptop or something, and get a good look at those shots, that's when you really know what you have for the day. And if you had slight misfocus situations that don't show on the LCD, but do show on these larger high resolution screens, you want to know about that before you get back home. And then there are other things too. Sometimes we may be experimenting with new camera settings, or our camera may do something differently than we expect. During RAW plus JPEG, we had one person shooting with filters in RAW plus JPEG, and if she set it up a certain way, she didn't get the RAW file, and that was a big surprise to her. And fortunately, she caught it because she was reviewing her images right after the shoot on her computer and could see what was going on there. She couldn't tell on her back of her camera, because the camera only shows you the JPEGs when you're reviewing them. She needed to look at her images on the computer to see that she had the JPEGs but no RAWs. Things like that only show up when you get those pictures off the camera and look at them on another device. So I think it's very important that you review your images as you go, and then that way you can make corrections while you're still on the road and not have, you know, some horrible surprise when you get home and you can't do anything about it. So those are my 5 tips that I have that we learned together in the Eastern Sierra. And I thought, man, it'd be great to share a few of those with our listeners, so you could be there with us in spirit. Story number 2, portrait tip: have the model hold the reflector. And this is just a quickie, but it can be very helpful. What we did on the last day of the workshop, the 3rd day of the workshop, is that we did some environmental portraiture around Bridgeport. It was a lot of fun, and Leah just looked fantastic. She had a cool little skirt and a pretty blouse, and she had her cowboy hat. She did pigtails, and she just fit in perfectly in the surroundings there in Bridgeport, California. And we worked with reflectors, we worked with fill flash, all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I showed folks, and of course, you know, a lot of folks know this, but sometimes reminders are helpful too, is that you can have the model hold the reflector if you're working by yourself. And basically all you have her or him do is hold the reflector, like a 42 inch or a 24 inch circular reflector. Have them hold it about waist high or even a little bit lower, depends on how they're comfortable and what kind of posing they're going to do, and have them bounce the light back up into their face. And, you know, I'll tell you, if the light's a little behind them so that you're getting a rim light on their hair, on their shoulders, and then it's catching that reflector and bouncing up into their face, it can be very attractive. And you would be surprised, for, again, we're talking about head and shoulder portraits here, not full length, but you'd be surprised for a head and shoulders portrait by having them continue to shift and twist and have their weight on one foot or another and holding this reflector while they're doing it. You can get some really nice shots, and you don't need an assistant. Just you and the person that you're taking a picture of and your set of 5-in-1 reflectors. Don't rule out using a reflector just because you don't have someone there to hold it. The models can hold it, and it'll give you a whole different look. So let's say that on this shoot where it's just you and the subject, you do some natural light work, you do some fill flash work, but there are some situations where a reflector would look really nice. Do this, have the model hold it, and you'd be surprised what you get. It can be very, very nice. Okay, let's take a stroll over to the screening room. Today's selection is iMovie 10.0.2 Essential Training with Garrick Chow. For a lot of folks that aren't having to do serious video editing, but want to produce a quality production every now and then, iMovie is really cool. But just like practically every other good video editor out there, you have to learn the ins and outs of it. And Garrick is very good at this. He's one of the best teachers at lynda.com. And this is a very good title. Now you can watch Garrick in action by visiting the TDS screening room at lynda.com/thedigitalstory. And while you're there, you can start your 7-day free trial to watch all of Garrick's movies, plus every other title in the library, including those from yours truly. So today's screening room selection is iMovie 10.0.2 Essential Training with Garrick Chow. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club news. I'm going to start out with an upcoming workshop, Moving from Aperture to Photos or Lightroom, on August 7th and 8th here in Santa Rosa, California at the Digital Story Studio. Now that Aperture is no longer being developed, many photographers are contemplating their next move. In this software workshop, we'll explore the two leading contenders, Photos for OS X, part of the Yosemite update, and Adobe Lightroom. So by the time we finish this workshop, you'll have a much clearer idea about your photo management future. We'll do tutorials on Lightroom. We'll do tutorials on Photos for OS X. Of course, we'll have our classic Digital Story workshop experience. It's really going to be a lot of fun. And I think, you know, if you haven't spent any time really thinking about your photo management in general, and you work on a Mac, I think you would benefit much from this workshop. Again, August 7th and 8th here in Santa Rosa, California. If you want a reservation form, just go to the TDS Workshops page at thedigitalstory.com. It's up there at the top in the nav bar. Go down the middle of the page, use the Send Me Info form. It has all of three fields. And then I will get you a reservation form, and you can come out and join us for this, what I think will be a terrific workshop. All right, moving along. Show off with SizzlePics. I talked about this a bit last week, but I want to reiterate it because we were talking about SizzlePics at the workshop. A number of the attendees have SizzlePics, and we're talking about, you know, when they have them up in a room, people look at them and comment on them, and that's just the way that it is. And if you don't have a couple showpiece images up, I would really consider the new 5K ultra high definition SizzlePics. It's just a fantastic rendering. And, you know, they were swapping stories about how, you know, what a handmade process this is, in the sense that when the technician at SizzlePics started working on their image, they might notice this or that, and they would send them an email and say, hey, did you know that you have this over here in the left corner? Do you want to leave it? Do you want me to take it out? What would you like me to do? And they were blown away by that. Someone was actually paying close attention to their artwork, making sure that it looked as good as possible once it was sizzled. And that's what you get with SizzlePics, and trust me, you don't get that everywhere else. So if you really want an artistic, handmade output on this beautiful polished aluminum surface, something that is environmentally friendly to produce and will last a long, long time, go to SizzlePix.com, order something, upload your favorite image, put in the comments field, proof first, TDS, and they'll even send you a little metal proof of section of your image so that you can see how wonderful it's going to look sizzled. And they have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. SizzlePics, it's like a retina display that you can hang on the wall. And one more week, I'm going to mention the, just in case you missed the other shows, the discounts and clearance page on Red River's website, and you can get there by clicking on the Red River tile on any of the Digital Story pages. And we were also talking about Red River paper and swapping notes about the different types of surfaces that photographers, you know, that each photographer likes using. It was a lot of fun. It was really neat hearing, you know, what people like to do. And we were actually looking at some samples printed on different types of Red River paper brought by workshop attendees, and kind of, you know, analyzing, you know, how this paper influenced the image one way and that paper influenced another way. These different stocks that Red River paper has can really influence how your image look in different ways. And it's really a lot of fun to experiment with them. So you can learn more and you can get some of this paper even more affordable than the normal 40% savings by going to the discount and clearance page at Red River Paper. And I have a link directly to it in the show notes. And of course, you can use the tile to shop for any of the paper stocks. You're going to get a great price on it because they make the paper and they sell the paper directly to you. And finally, if you're ordering through B&H or Amazon, please click on the respective ad tile under the product's header in the box halfway down the column on thedigitalstory.com. That helps support the site. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for me this week. I need to take a shower, in all honesty. Like I said, I just got off the road. I wanted to record this so we can stay on schedule. I just want to tell you, if you can't tell already, I had an amazing time in the Eastern Sierra. I really enjoyed the people, and I'm seriously leaning toward doing it again next year. If you like adventure like this, I think you would love coming to this workshop. Just make a mental note about that so that when I talk about next year's workshop schedule, you get on the reservation list quickly. All right, that's going to do it for me. Until next week, have a great week. Go take some shots. Bye-bye now.